This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
There's a wedding thing. Okay. And do we start yet? Our sisters can come forward to the left of the room. Okay. Just waiting for a signal to start. Abdullah, perhaps. Can we start, ya Kohari? I don't know how he would tell me. Ah, okay, great. طيب الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على رسوله الأمين وعلى آله وصحبه أجمعين. أما بعد, جزاكم الله خيرا for staying and for the next series, we're going to be taking five lessons each time from one of the lives of the four khulafa. And today we're starting with Umar radiallahu anhu, even though we should start with Abu Bakr, but our Sheikh Waleed specifically wanted to do Abu Bakr and he's not in town, so we're starting with Umar, and then so we're not going in order specifically. But five lessons from the life of Umar, and you know, I mean, his khilafah was 10 years and he instituted many firsts. He was the first to do this and first to do that. So there are a lot of lessons, but obviously, yeah, since I'm the speaker, I obviously chose the ones that I like very much. I would say two very powerful, three more mild, so it's not a long night. I'll start with the first one. The first one, we start in during the reign of Umar, when he's the Khalifa already. So this is after the Prophet ﷺ, this is after Abu Bakr, and he's the Khalifa now. So he's in a room with some of the companions, and he's going to teach them a lesson. So he says, make a wish. Then one of them says, I wish that this room were filled with gold coins, and I would spend it for the sake of Allah. That's the wish. And if one of us now wished that this whole room would just stacked with dollar bills, $100 bills from the floor to the ceiling, and he would spend it for the sake of Allah, you say, mashallah, that's a great wish. We will build masajid and Islamic schools, you know that talk, right? Fantastic wish. Umar radiallahu anhu tells him that is not the wish. So the next man, he increased the item and changed the expenditure. He said, I wish this room were filled with gold coins and gems. So something else that's valuable to fill the room with. And I will spend it for the sake of Allah and jihad on the path of Allah. So changed what he's going to spend on and changed the items, added one more. And Umar radiallahu anhu tells them that's not the wish either. So they realize now that he's trying to teach them a lesson. So they said, what is the wish, Ya Amir al-Mu'mineen? And listen to what he says. He says, I wish that this room were filled with men like Abu Ubaidah, Amir ibn al-Jarrah radiallahu anhu, and I would use them fi sabilillah, for the path of Allah, on the path of Allah. What such an amazing, amazing way of thinking. Umar radiallahu anhu valued people more so than buildings, more so than wealth and money and all that. It was about people. If you look at the history of Islam, what brought it to where it is today? It's people. And more so, I mean, of course, money had its place, and that's why the Prophet ﷺ said, no wealth has benefited me more than the wealth of Abu Bakr. It has its place. But imagine you have all the wealth in the world and no men. And by men, we mean women also. It doesn't mean just males. But imagine you have all the wealth and no people. What does it do? Absolutely nothing. But the real question is, where did Umar radiallahu anhu learn to make to understand this, the value of people over buildings and wealth and stuff like that? Okay. And I'm going to warn you in advance that I'm going to get angry. I'm the kind that if something angers me, I get angry visibly, during the talk, even though it's an old issue, but I get angry. I'm just warning you in advance, okay? Because it's, you're going to get angry too, but we'll get there. We'll get angry together, but just wait. For now, where did Umar learn this? Where did he learn this valuable lesson? If you go back to how Umar became Muslim, he became Muslim as a result of a dua of the Prophet ﷺ. And this dua is, I know we all know it, but this dua is the strangest dua you'll ever hear in your life. It's so strange. The Prophet ﷺ wanted to make dua to Allah to give victory to Islam. So how would you make dua to give victory to Islam? Oh Allah, give us power over our enemies. Oh Allah, give us victory. Oh Allah, increase our numbers. Oh Allah, bring benefit through these people who are already Muslim. Oh Allah, give us this much wealth. Oh Allah, destroy the enemies and just give us the upper hand suddenly like that. So many du'as, right? But the Prophet ﷺ made the strangest du'a ever. He said, Oh Allah, give victory to Islam, a'izz al-Islam, with one of these two men. And then he mentions Amr ibn Hisham, and that is Abu Jahl, or Umar ibn al-Khattab. Such a strange du'a. Yani, who thinks like this? Prophets are in a different frequency. Yani. Prophet ﷺ is asking victory for Islam, izzah, dignity and honor for Islam through one man. But why didn't he say through Hamza ibn Abdul Muttalib, who was Muslim already, or through Ali ibn Abi Talib, or through Talha ibn Ubaidillah, or Abdurrahman ibn Auf, or Abu Bakr as-Siddiq, the best of the prophets? I would have made dua for Abu Bakr. He didn't make dua for anyone with him, or for a group of people with him, or to just remove all the leaders of the Quraysh overnight. They all die in their sleep. You know, one of them cholesterol, the other, you know, heart attack. Yeah. It's such a strange dua that the Prophet ﷺ understood that victory can come to a religion through one person. That's the first thing. The second thing, that he made dua for Allah to guide one of the enemies of Islam. I shared this with Sheikh Walid Basuni one time, and he said something interesting. He said, that's like putting your hands up and saying, Oh Allah, give victory to Islam through either George Bush or Tony Blair. Yani at the height of invasions and all that stuff, you know. Imagine a dua like that. Imagine your imam in Taraweeh, Oh Allah, give victory to Islam through either George Bush or Tony Blair. We'll beat him up right after Taslim. True or false? So it's... okay. So it's just such an amazing dua. But this dua gets you to value people. Sah? This dua gets you to value people. It shows you the power of one person. That the Prophet ﷺ asked for victory for this entire religion through one person. And either one of these two people. It's so amazing, isn't it? Am I the only one blown away by this? Or is this... Yeah? It's amazing. So Umar radiallahu anhu understood the value of people. Today, we look at the value of buildings and all kinds of other things, but we don't value people as much. We don't invest in people very much. And when I say we, I mean the Muslims. Here, there, wherever. All of them guilty of this. Yani right now, if we put two boxes in the room and they said, one, donations in this box for building a masjid. And donations over here for scholarships, for someone who wants to study and wants to go overseas to Mauritania or Al-Azhar or Medina and study Islam and come back and benefit the Muslim society in Houston. Honestly, tell me, which box would get more donations? The masjid. We're building-oriented, cash-oriented, money-oriented. We don't believe in invest, or maybe we haven't learned to invest in people enough. And that's why if you say we want to give money to students of knowledge or for scholarships, building, I can see. What if the student of knowledge dies on the way to Medina? What? That's when you work at a company, they pay you your ticket to fly to California, right, Nick? They fly you to California. They get you a hotel room. They get you a rental car. You take a course over the weekend, and they fly you back. And you might quit when you come back, but they invest in people, and this is a problem. So, and this is where we get angry. And in my years of travel, okay, decade of traveling around the U.S., all over the U.S., I would always be invited by the imams and the board and everything to a room after a lecture, and they would show me a blueprint on the wall. And they would say, this is the new structure that we're building. It will cost about $8 million, and it's going to have a basketball court and a multi-purpose hall and a wedding hall and a divorce room and a prayer area and this and this and that. and it will cost us this many millions. And I've always never had the courage to ask, but I always in my mind think, how much are you going to pay the imam who's going to run this multi-million dollar structure? And the answer is, we'll pay him minimum wage. We'll give him 25,000 a year, and a 1987 Corolla that has a hole this big on the side of the door. This is, we will spend millions on a structure, but we'll pay the guy who's supposed to run that structure minimum wage. And imam in the US is not like imam overseas. Until now, overseas, for the most part, the masjid is not like a center. Like if you have a problem with your wife, you don't bring her to the masjid. Here, the masjid is for counseling. The masjid is for everything. You catch your child with drugs, you bring them to the masjid. Everything happens in the masjid. Marriage, everything is here. And this imam has to do all that. And we want to pay him minimum wage or less than that. And I can tell you stories. I know of an imam in California. And khalas, enough said, California. It's expensive already, right? He gets, his salary is 25,000 a year. And he has five children. 25,000 a year in California? Yeah, if you're single, 25,000 a year in Houston, you're like, khalas, poor guy. We have to get donations for you. Five children in Houston, you could barely make it. Five children in California. And that's what they pay him, 25,000 a year. And they gave me, I have to give the khutbah in his masjid, they gave me this little card that said, the building across the street is on sale, and it costs $6.5 million, and we'd like to buy it. So tell people to donate for that. I was just thinking, how does this imam feel when, because let me tell you, they had a building this way, in front of the masjid, that they already bought. It's like a seven-story building that they bought years ago because it was for sale. And they own the land and the huge parking lot. They don't even need that building and they don't know what to do with it. It's empty. And now the next building is for sale. Let's buy it for $6.5 million. They just want to spend on these buildings. But the imam who runs the show and does everything in the counseling, $25,000 a year. I can tell you worse stories. And these are stories I know personally. There's a masjid in Mississauga near Toronto. And in Canada. And they have in their contract for the imam that four makes of vehicles that he's not allowed to purchase. It says in the contract, you are not allowed to buy Mercedes, Infiniti, Lexus, I'm making them up, Acura. They have four makes of vehicles you can't buy. Why? Because you're the imam. Another true story. This imam, it's sad, man. It's sad. This imam bought a Mercedes. Board member came to his house that night. Couldn't even wait till the next day. Came to his house. How can you buy an expensive car? You're supposed to be a role model and drive a beat up car. When I used to be a role model and I had the beat up car, I didn't see any of you following my example and selling your Mercedes and Porsches and everything. But what is the message we're sending to people? And what is the message we're sending to our children when the doctor, the engineer, they can all, ride nice cars, whatever, the imam? 1987 Corolla with a hole this big on the side. And a board member will come and check the size of the hole. No, brother, the hole not big enough. What is this, Yani? There's another imam, he's got business overseas. So when he bought a fancy car, community started saying he stole from the masjid. Because imam cannot have a nice car. This is what we're conditioned. There was a community after Isha, impromptu fundraising. They raised $500,000 to put a dome in the masjid. And the guy grabbed the microphone after Isha. Brothers and sisters, as you know, there is no dome in this masjid. And I hope you guys know, your salah is not accepted in a building with no dome. You guys know that, right? Okay, I'm being sarcastic. They dropped $500,000 on that dome right after Isha to make this dome. $500,000. The imam, he's $24,000 a year or something like that. So we don't, you see this overseas also. So you'll go, and I'm talking from personal experience. I'll go to places in the Middle East and in Africa, and they'll show me this new structure and facility that they built, and it cost this many millions of dollars, and state-of-the-art this and state-of-the-art that, and engineers and designers from this and that. You come a 2 years later, and the place is destroyed. Why? Because they didn't spend $1 training the staff that will maintain this structure that cost you $12 million. We have a problem of spending on people. We don't spend on people. The only time I worked with a masjid, it was in Canada. And at the university, they have these magazines that have all these kinds of courses on them and everything. So I found a course on divorce law in Canada. I don't know divorce law in Canada, inheritance law in Canada. It's a course, a 2 or 3 hour long course, $150. I circle about 4 or 5 of them that I need, you know, inheritance law, all these things, marriage law in Canada, divorce law in Canada. I need that as an imam. Circle them, I give it to the president. I said, pay for these courses for me and for the imam. We need to know this stuff. Yeah. How many of our imams now, or how many boards? Let's just go to every masjid in North America and visit all the boards and say, okay, your imam needs training. And there's a course on counseling and it costs $3,000. How many boards do you think would be willing to pay $3,000 so the imam can take a course on counseling? How many? Most of them be like, what if we pay this and then he quits and what? Nonsense, Bas. Nonsense. And why do you need a course on counseling? Just sit like this, tilt your head and keep your eyes half open and just do this. It looks like you care. Bas kida. Yes, brother. And at the end say, sabr, brother, be patient. Bas khalas. Yahi, with counseling, there is even a way to sit when someone has a problem and they're trying to tell it to you. Someone has a problem, an addiction, and it's embarrassing. So you don't sit like this, tell me. La, a'udhu billah. You do that, it's embarrassing. They tell you, you face away from them, with your body and with your face. So they don't feel embarrassed that you're glaring them down and giving expressions. Best kid. How many imams know that? And I don't want to be crass, but imagine a young man walks into the imam's office. Pick any masjid in North America. He goes into the imam. First of all, what are the odds that will happen? But yalla, put that aside. He goes in and he tells the imam, Ya Sheikh, I think, I know there's some young people in the audience, but let's say the guy is not renting his home. He's a homeowner. A homeowner. Fahimtu? Hello. So the guy doesn't rent. And he thinks, Imam, I think I might be a homeowner. Help me. Yalla, honestly, do you think our imams are equipped to deal with that issue? What do you think he'll tell him? What do you think he'll tell him? Ittaqillah, just make dhikr. Things that will do nothing for him. Not nothing, yani. But as far as practically helping this person? So we, again, maybe it's too long of a tangent from this one point. But it's just brilliant that 1,400 years ago we had the lesson. And we're just learning it now. We're just learning it now. I know of a masjid in New York City that has 5 imams. One of them, janazas. You die, he's there, mashallah. The other guy, durus, khutab classes, he's there. The third guy does the 5 prayers. That's his thing. The fourth guy, wedding, divorce, he's there. And I forgot what the fifth guy does. But that's really like the workload. You know, imams say 70% of their time is spent counseling. And we don't even provide them training for counseling. 70% of their time. So they're in the masjid the whole time. One time this masjid wanted to talk to me about a job in Toronto. And it was like after a conference, midnight, I went to them. And I said, what are the hours? What do you expect from me so I can deliver? So I can tell you if I can deliver. They said, we want you to be like us. Yani aslan, what kind of job interview is this when they tell you, we want you to be like us. I asked about my hours, he said, we want you to be like us. I said, what does that mean? They said, we've been here since Fajr and now it's midnight. Tabi Sharaik, I don't want to be like you, ever. I don't want to be like you. I don't want to come here from Fajr and stay until midnight. And you know what imams do also? When they're preparing when they go home, they're not vacationing. They're preparing their class. You know, for some imams, it takes them anywhere from 3 to 6 hours worth of preparation for a 1 hour lecture. 3 to 6 hours. So when they go home, they're still working. Yeah? Anyways, you get the idea? We can stop? It's a bit too much, right? But it's just such a problem that we still don't know the value of spending on people and investing in people, investing in students of knowledge and scholarships and helping people with their, you know, with their tuition. I've never, okay, I've never in my, you know, this many years of that and such, never ever heard an announcement, brothers and sisters, there's a person who needs help with their tuition. We've heard there's a person who needs help with rent, with this, with that. But it, wallah, it befits that we value individuals, we value people more than buildings. We need to make that shift. And it's happening now, but it's very slow, very slow. Okay? Anyways, khalas, point, wasalat, we stop, we move on. The happy stuff. Naam? Alhamdulillah, I controlled it a little bit shwaya this time. Yeah. But it just makes you angry though, yeah. Khalas. So that's number one. Umar radiallahu anhu understood the value of people. We say the most cash-rich area in the world is where? The most cash-rich area in the world. You know it. The Middle East. The most cash-rich area in the world. So, you know, people estimate, oh, wallahi, the problem with our ummah, we don't have money. La, we have money. And our community, mashallah, has money, and we have doctors and engineers, and we have money. The problem with our ummah, we have no brains. Really? Walk into any hospital and say, I want to talk to the top heart surgeon. Itla' lak Dr. Mithat, Dr. Siddiqui, Dr. Khan, yes? The best brain surgeon, Dr. Siddiqui also. There we have brains, yeah? Go to NASA, kulla scientists, Arabs and Pakistanis and Indians, mathematicians. But when the rover lands on Mars, the white guy comes in front of the camera. Well, it landed about 1400 hours and the Arab guy's behind the camera, that was my idea. They don't put him in front of the camera. We have brains, we have cash. But let's move on. Point number two is the lesson from Umar's life, his gentleness. The gentleness of Umar. The gentleness of Umar, like we know Umar to be harsh and stuff. Like, relax, shway. First of all, many, many times when a speaker gives a talk about Umar and his personality, they do not analyze his personality properly. They always present Umar as this wild man who's willing to pull out his sword and chop someone's head off. And they even mention narrations. You know that narration about the Jewish man who had a dispute with a hypocrite, and the hypocrite's pretending to be Muslim. They go to the Prophet ﷺ, who judges for the Jew. So the hypocrite, who's Muslim, says, I don't accept this judgment, let's go to Abu Bakr. They go to Abu Bakr, he also judges for the Jew. He says, I don't accept the judgment, let's go to Umar. They come to Umar's house, and Umar says, let me get this straight. The Prophet ﷺ judged, and you didn't accept his judgment? Wait here. He goes in, gets his sword, comes out, chops his head off, and when his head falls on the floor, he says, this is my judgment on you. And then it got to the point where, because Umar killed what looks like a Muslim, it got to the point where the Prophet ﷺ had to execute Umar, and then Allah sent down the verse in Surah Al-Nisa, فَلَا وَرَبِّكَ لَا يُؤْمِنُونَ. No, by your Lord, they do not believe until حَتَّى يُحَكِّمُوكَ فِي مَا شَجَرَ بَيْنَهُمْ ثُمَّ لَا يَجِدُوا فِي أَنفُسِهِمْ حَرَجْ مِمَّا قَضَيْتَ وَيُسَلِّمُوا تَسْلِيمًا. Ibn Kathir mentions this and he says this narration is very strange. Yani, it's not an acceptable narration. Do you think Umar would kill a Muslim? Forget that question. Would you kill a Muslim? Yani, some Muslim does something you don't like, the parking lot, you backs into your car, you just come. Then get in your car, drive off. Would you do that? La. طيب, Umar, radiallahu anhu, the second best man in Islam, and he's just going to murder someone? Of course, it's some crazy false narration. So, no, he never did any of that stuff. So, some are just these fabricated, false, weak narrations. But what about when Hatib ibn Abi Balta'a, he alerted the Meccans to the invasion of the conquering of Mecca, and Umar radiallahu anhu said, Ya Rasulullah, let me strike the neck of this hypocrite. Or when Abdullah ibn Ubay ibn Salul, the leader of the hypocrites in Medina, said something, and then Umar ibn Khattab said, Ya Rasulullah, let me strike the neck of this hypocrite. And the Prophet ﷺ would always say, no, so that people don't say Muhammad kills his companions. So then, were there actual correct narrations that showed some kind of, let's just call it, strict, harsh behavior from the side of Umar? So who's best to explain it? He will explain it himself, in his own words, not in my words or anybody. He explained it. Because when he became the Khalifa, he heard and he saw people were visibly scared of him. So they said that when Abu Bakr would come by a road, the children would run to him, ya abati, and you know, father, and he would like wipe their heads and, you know. But when Umar would turn by the road, grown men, everyone just scattered. And then when he leaves again, the people come back and start buying and selling and talking. So Umar found out how people are scared of him, and what did it do to him? It saddened him. It saddened him, so he gathered the people. As-salatu jami'a, people gathered, and he gave the following speech. He said, he explains his harshness, and just listen to his explanation. He says, أيها الناس, O people, كنت مع رسول الله صلى الله عليه وسلم, I used to be with the Prophet صلى الله عليه وسلم, فَكُنْتُ عَبْدُهُ وَخَادِمُهُ يعني I was his عبد يعني his like his servant looks like a slave servant and at his service وكان رسول الله صلى الله عليه وسلم ألين الناس and the Prophet was the most gentle of people وأرق الناس and the most merciful of people فقلت so I said to myself I will أضع شدتي إلى لينه I'm going to put my strictness or my harshness for lack of a better term I'm going to put my harshness to contrast his gentleness you see what's happening here look how sweet Umar radiallahu anhu is and how considerate he is فأكون he said فأكون سيفا so I'll be a sword unsheathed an unsheathed sword بين يدي between his hands يعني he's also saving face for the Prophet sallam so if so he would be the one to suggest something that would be harsh so that the suggestion wouldn't come from the Prophet sallam you understand يعني if something happened the Prophet sallam was very upset with it Umar would make the harsh suggestion and the Prophet sallam would just stay quiet so I'm being that person for him the unsheathed sword بين يديه between his hands or فإن شاء or if he wills أغمدني الغماد is the sheath of the sword so he will just sheath the sword again so I'll be a sword willing to do whatever he needs me to do but if he wants he will just sheath that sword back again so no damage nothing will happen وإن شاء تركني and if he wills he would let me loose on people فأمضي إلى ما يريد so then I'll do whatever he wishes and he says And I continued with the Prophet ﷺ, وَنِيَّتِي كَذَلِكَ And that's my intention. I'm just there, willing to do something, always suggesting so that the suggestion doesn't come for the Prophet ﷺ, the unsheathed sword, or he can pull me back and put me back in the sheath, and that's it. حَتَّى تَوَفَّاهُ اللَّهُ وَهُوَ رَاضٍ عَنِّي Until Allah took his soul while he's pleased with me. Then he says, then Abu Bakr, and I'm, it's getting too long, so let me just go through. He says, then Abu Bakr came. And again, Abu Bakr is gentle. So now he's going to put his harshness in contrast to Abu Bakr's lean or gentleness. So, and then he will use me as an unsheathed sword or hold me back if he wanted to. And then that was my intention with him until Allah took his soul and he died while he was pleased with me. Yani not once did the Prophet ﷺ complain to the companions, that Umar is a bit too harsh, he's always like trying to hurt people and I have to keep holding him back. He was pleased with him. Abu Bakr, same way, was pleased with him, never complained. Then he says, now, he explains that now there isn't any gentleness that I have to contrast with harshness. So he says to the people that now that harshness has decreased a lot, but it's still there for the people of who do injustice. And then he describes very beautifully that if any of the people of injustice do anything against the people of righteousness and deen, then I will put their faces, look, watch now. I'll put their faces down to the ground, and I'll put my foot, their cheek on the ground, and my other cheek, my foot on their other cheek. See the image? But then he says, then, ثُمَّ بَعْدَ ذَلِكَ And then after all that, أَضَعُ خَدِّي عَلَى التُّرَابِ And I'll put my cheek on the sand. لأهل العفاف والدين So to the people basically of righteousness and religiosity, I put my cheek on the ground and let them put their foot on my other cheek. You see what's happening here? So he's saying that Umar that was harsh is no more. This is a gentle Umar and there's no gentleness that I had to contrast. So now that's gone, except against people of injustice, I'm still going to be firm. But as for the people of religiosity and righteousness, I'm going to let them step on my cheek. So there is that gentle side of Umar. Now, something else interesting. After the Battle of Badr, the Prophet ﷺ made a decision on how to deal with the captives. And Allah said in the Quran that was the wrong decision. So Umar radiallahu anhu comes the next day and finds Abu Bakr and the Prophet ﷺ crying. Because Allah, for lack of a better term, reprimanded them in the Quran. So he found them crying. So look what he says to them. And only someone who's gentle can say this. He says, what is making you cry? Tell me so that if it concerns me, I'll cry. And if it doesn't concern me, بَكَيْتُ لِبُكَائِكُمَا I'll cry because you're crying. And that's a gentle person who can say that. And a lot of us in this room, we can't do that right now. Sisters are good at that, mashallah. And it's commendable, it's not an insult. It's commendable that You can feel so much empathy for your friend that you can cry with your friend. And we have evidence for that also. In case you think I'm just making fun, the hadith of Aisha, the hadith of Al-Ifk, in Sahih Bukhari, she said, because she was accused, Aisha radiallahu anha, she's crying. She said, then an Ansari woman came, knocked on the door, asked for permission, came inside, sat down and started crying next to me. Nobody insulted her. Why is she crying? That's how a good friend is. So Umar radiallahu anhu is such a good friend and he's such a sweet man that he said, I will cry because you're crying, even if it doesn't concern me. How many of us can do that? Some of us now, and if your friend is crying, you try to cheer him up. Let's go get some kebab or something. That kebab and lahma, that's the only way we can make them feel happy. But that's another level of gentleness and empathy, right? So it shows that it wasn't just a madman who's always out to try to strike people. But all the narrations that are authentic are when someone did something incredibly wrong. So he wanted to present that harsh offer and not the Prophet ﷺ. And the Prophet ﷺ, if he accepted, khalas. If he said no, he would hold him back. And he said, like, I'm being like a soldier at the hands of the Prophet ﷺ. So other things about his personality show you that he was just a normal person and a gentle person. When it came time for seriousness, he was serious. And that's why Umar radiallahu anhu is known for being very good at understanding people's problems. During the reign of Abu Bakr, a man came and he was not making any sense. Like, he's speaking in sentences, but they were just incoherent, not making any sense. So Abu Bakr had Umar sit down with him. Why Umar? And when I asked the class this, they would say, oh, to scare him. Scare him? The guy can't even speak because he's in shock. He's going to have someone scare him? Because Umar was good with people and he was good at understanding people's personal problems. So Umar actually calmed the man down and the man explained to him what had happened. And yani, I don't want to say it, there are too many young people in the room, but something bad happened to him, okay? Of that nature. So the point is, yalla mashi halak. After Fajr, Umar radiallahu anhu said that we would sit, we would pray Fajr with the Prophet ﷺ, and then we would sit to the side and we'd tell stories of Jahiliyyah, the things we used to do before Islam. And he said, I told the story of how one time I wanted to worship an idol, but I didn't have enough money. So I had some dates and I shaped the idol out of the dates. And then I went on a journey and would get hungry and apologize to the god and eat the right arm, then eat the left arm. Then I'm so sorry, I have to eat your left leg, then your right leg. I'm so sorry, I have to eat your torso. Then after a while, I'm really hungry, God, I have to eat your head now. I apologize, I'll rebuild you as well and get back to the... And they were doing this in the masjid, by the way, laughing. And he said the Prophet ﷺ would be over there making his dhikr, and he would yaltafit ilayna wa yatabassam. Prophet ﷺ would turn to us and just smile. Maybe he doesn't even hear the stories, but he would turn and smile. You know what? Yeah, it's halal to talk in the masjid. I went to a masjid in Virginia one time. It says on all four walls, do not speak. And people would see each other and do this. They couldn't speak. Why can't you speak? Or if someone is laying down like this, sit properly, you're in the masjid. Wallah, يعني, I have to be like this in the masjid? I can't relax like this in the masjid ever? Sit properly, it's a masjid. طيب يا أخي, when the Prophet ﷺ came and found Ali ibn Abi Talib laying down in the masjid and said, قم يا أبا تراب. What about that? People were relaxed, people were talking and everything. He didn't tell them, make dhikr of Allah. He just smiled at them. Anyways. Wallahi, I spent Ramadan in New York, and I would go to these masajid, and there would be like seven people. All the youth are in the masjid, and there would be like seven people scattered around the musalla, just yelling at the youth, hey, sit up, it's not a farm, sit up, it's a masjid. I'm like, yeah, it's a masjid, yeah, what? Let him talk, let this guy lay down, let him scratch. Don't scratch. Yeah, you just don't scratch, maybe he has lice. You have to scratch if you have lice. Let him scratch. Yeah, yani. All right, so many times people do not analyze the personality of Umar properly. He had a gentle personality and he was a normal person. If something made him angry, he would get angry and he would put that forward so that the Prophet ﷺ didn't have to get angry and put it forward. And the Prophet ﷺ would pull back or let him. And I personally right now cannot think of a single time when the Prophet ﷺ said, yeah, go for it. He always held them back, true or false, right? I can't think of, maybe there's one, but almost always, Prophet is just pulling him back, right? All right, so that was the second thing. So the first thing, Umar valued people over money and buildings, and we should learn from that. The second thing, the gentle side of Umar. And I have to say that because in life you meet a lot of rude people who would tell you, I'm like Umar. They see something really rude and they smile and say, I'm like Umar. La, you're not like Umar. You just get al-adab. You're just rude, that's all. You're not like Umar. You're just rude. I think Umar was just some rude, vulgar guy walking around being nasty to everybody and hurting feelings and stuff. No, you're not like Umar. But people don't know Umar or they misanalyze his personality. Every guy who's mean, he thinks he's like Umar. One of our friends in Virginia, I was giving him nasiha. He was super rude to people. So I'm telling him, ya akhi, be nice, don't be rude. You're very harsh with people. And as I'm talking to him, he's cutting me off saying, I know that. I think the humility of admitting it makes it okay. I know that. If you know that, fix it. It's not acceptable. He said, but now, this is the worst thing when you have evidence for bad manners. When you have evidence to hate someone, or evidence to envy, or to be a hater. This is the worst thing when you think you have Islamic evidence. And the guy tells me, but, Musa alayhi salam, when the angel of death came to him, he punched him. This is your evidence for being rude to people? You're trying to say Musa alayhi salam was rude? I'd like to see you punch the angel of death. The comparison is, it's just another planet. Completely wrong anyways. Yeah. You know? Anyways. So, that was two. Number three, wanted to talk about the justice and the fairness of Umar radiallahu anhu. And, tafaddal. Hello. طيب, the full story, I probably should have said the full story is, back then, the angel of death used to come to prophets in the form of a human being and seek their permission, يعني, for death or not. He came to Musa alayhi salam, this is before, يعني, it's not the moment of when he took his soul. He came to him, and Musa alayhi salam, yes, he did have a temper. And you can have a temper, but you control it. يعني, Abu Bakr had a temper. I don't know if you look at his biography, Abu Bakr actually had a quick temper. But Umar is more famous for his temper, even though Abu Bakr had a faster temper, a shorter fuse. But why? Because he controlled it more. So it's fine, have a temper, get angry quickly, but control it. Yeah, it's not the sin to have a temper, the sin is when you let it loose. So Musa alayhi salam thought it was just some guy fooling around and he struck him, you know. But then at a later time or what have you, the angel of death came and took his soul. Wallahu ta'ala. All right. Ibn Abbas radiallahu anhu, the companion, he used to say, أكثر من ذكر عمر بن الخطاب. He used to say, mention a lot or mention عمر بن الخطاب a lot. He says, فإنكم إن ذكرتم عمر ذكرتم العدل. Because indeed, if you mention عمر, you will mention justice. And if you mention justice, you'll mention Allah. So, what stood out about Umar radiallahu anhu to this companion, Abdullah ibn Abbas radiallahu anhu, was that he was so just, his justice. So we'll just take three, or just some quick examples. But another really powerful quote is a messenger sent by Heraclius. So Heraclius now, so this is not a Muslim now. Heraclius sends a messenger to Umar. So the messenger comes to Medina. Where is your leader? Where is Umar? And he's lying under the tree. Remember, this guy comes from the Eastern Roman Empire, basically, the Byzantine Empire. And you've got guards and all that for their leaders. And he's asking, where's the leader of the Muslims, this powerful new empire? And he's like that man sleeping under the tree. He looks around and there are no soldiers standing or doing anything. This man is just sleeping alone. So he says, حكمت فعدلت, or they say, حكمت فعدلت فأمنت فنمت. That's what he said. Four words. It's so beautiful. He says, you ruled, you were just, so you felt safe, so you slept. And that's because Umar was so fair to everybody, nobody had an issue. So he just slept under the tree. There were no bodyguards or anything like that. And of course, it's not realistic to expect that today. And I've seen people do that today. One time I was with a friend on a bus, this is overseas, and a motorcade of the president of the country passed. My friend says, Umar, you should sleep under the tree. Yes, Habibi, that was before. I guarantee you, if you become president tomorrow, you're not sleeping under no tree. Unless that tree is inside a bunker, honey, and you have guns everywhere. Umar radiallahu anhu one time, he brought Muawiyah ibn Abi Sufyan, Amr ibn al-As, and Khalid ibn Walid. And he says, I want to appoint two of you to be governors, one in Asham, one in Egypt. But with the condition that we count all your wealth right now, and at the end of your term, we see whatever wealth you have, we'll take the excess and give you exactly what you started with. It sounds like a bad job offer, right? Well, how much is in your bank account now? Our company will hire you, and at the end of the year, we'll make sure there's only 1,000 or 200 or whatever is in your bank account. Also, but what do I make from this? So Khalid bin Walid says, أَرَأَيْتَ إِنْ اتَّجَرَ أَحَدُنَا أَتَمْنَعُهُ? He says, what if one of us goes into like business and will you prevent him? And Umar said, yes. So Khalid bin Walid said, I'm out. And he didn't like these terms. He said, I'm out. So Umar radiallahu anhu made Muawiyah governor or ruler over Asham, Amir of Asham, and he put Amr ibn al-As ruler over or Amir over. Aywa Miss Akid, right? So then there's the story. It's a really nice story and it's a quick one. How long have we been going on? It's like long, huh? Huh? Yeah, okay. The other two are short anyways. So Umar radiallahu anhu walks by this area, or one narration says an area known as Al-Hima, where they used to let all the animals graze for free here. But the other says he was in the market, and then he noticed some camels that were exceptionally bigger and fatter than all the other camels. So he said, who do these belong to? They said they belong to your son. So they're exceptionally fatter than all the rest. There's something wrong here. So Umar calls his son. He said, what's the story with these camels? He says, I bought them and I let them graze in Al-Hima like any other Muslim, like anyone would let their animals graze there. So Umar says, he tells him, yeah, and they said, meaning the people, because they're your camels, they said, let the camels of the son of Amir al-Mu'mineen graze first. Let them graze longer. Let them drink. Give them better access to food. Give them longer access to the water. Give them first access to water. That's why your camels are fatter than everyone else's. So you sell them, and whatever capital you invested, whatever capital you paid, take back your capital, and the Prophet put it back into the treasury of the Muslims, into Bayt al-Mal. Because they got preferential treatment. And they look better than every other camel, because by virtue of you being the son of Amir al-Mu'mini. This is how fair and just he was with his own family. And he would not allow them any favoritism or any advantages or anything like that. In another popular story, and there are like two versions of this story, his wife with the oil. In one version, Amr ibn al-As brings oil, like, and it's like musk oil, and it's like basically they're like lumps like this. And they need someone to weigh it and sell it to the believers. And Umar said, I wish I knew a woman who could weigh and sell it. Why a woman? Because it used to be the woman who would be in charge of this kind of thing. And he's selling the perfumes or. So his wife said, I know how to do that. Now in this narration, he lets her, she sells, she's selling all throughout the day. And as you're breaking this with your hand smells great. What do? Wash it. Your hand smells great. What do? Dilu. Yeah. Aywa. Uh-huh. So when he came back at night, he smelled the strong smell in the house. And he said, what happened? She said, she explained to him a little bit here and there. And she would just wipe her finger off. And he took it. And if you could just see him, he's washing it to get the scent out, because it wasn't a gift for you, for the wife of the Khalifa. The guy said, and break it up and sell it. He didn't say, let your wife use it, but now you've got some of it on you. So if you could see him washing, and then he would smell again, no, still there, wash again. Just checking and washing, checking and washing. The other narration is that he refused to allow her to be the one to do it. Because he tells her, she said, why? Because he said, you're going to go with your finger hakada, like this, touch it, and then you're going to go like this. Because that's what happens when a good scent comes on your finger. You wipe it off. And you clean it off like that. We're saying that we can learn from this level of justice with Umar radiallahu anhu. So fair with whoever he's in charge of. And we say, okay, we're not khulafa. But like we said before, every one of us is in charge of something. At work, you're a manager, if you're a business owner, if you've got younger siblings you take care of, if you're married and you have children, if you're just married and you don't have children, you're still in charge of someone. Or maybe it's the other way around. That's another talk. Maybe she's in charge. But the point is that, in the end, are we just like Umar radiallahu anhu? And I don't want to go into it, but so many people are so unfair. So unfair to their family and to their wives, and threats and this and... Khalas, leave that. My wife might be watching. I don't want to sound hypocritical. Number four, this is very quick. A beautiful and short description of Umar. It appears in Sahih al-Bukhari. وَكَانَ وَقَّافًا عِنْدَ كِتَابِ اللَّهِ. Such a short but beautiful description. That Umar, he used to stop at the Book of Allah, meaning at the boundaries and the limits of the Book of Allah. يعني you might find someone when it's a good day. When it's a good day, everyone's a good Muslim. When it's a good day, everyone's a good Muslim and smiling and happy. When you're having a bad day, that's when your true worth, your true caliber shows. So it's like these people who tell you, I'm very calm and less provoked. Wallah, that's the whole world. Nobody wakes up provoked, yani. Everyone's calm and less provoked. So your calmness doesn't count. When provoked, if you're calm, now we give you a thumbs up. If you get provoked and you lose it, خلاص, then you're not a calm person. Yeah. So what happens, like you find that person when it's a good day, خلاص, they're a good day, they're calm and smiling and everything. But when they lose it, and then you tell them, خلاص, يخي, calm down, make wudu, ittaqi Allah, خلاص, nothing you say, no ayah you would hit them with, would get them to stop. But Umar radiallahu anhu, he could be in the middle of an intense rage, and if you tell him a verse, he stops right there. Yeah. One time, and I'll close with this, yani, for this point. But this happened one time. I was in an office with this sheikh, visiting the sheikh in his office. Then a third guy came. And this guy had, yani, a lot of tests in his life. So he's going to a job interview, and he had a flat tire. And then he checked his spare, and the spare was flat. But he comes really angry. And he would say things, astaghfirullah, things like, yani, why is Allah doing this to me? What does he want from me? Yani, wallahi, this is how we are. You drive with a flat spare, and then you, for months, and then when you have a flat tire, you're like, why did Allah do this? Wallahi, you did it, ya Habibi. You did it. No one wants to take responsibility for anything anymore. Anything. So, he came and he's just pacing back and forth, angry. And it had to happen on the day of my interview, and I couldn't make the interview, and of course, I'm not even going to go to it, they're not going to hire me and everything. And the sheikh kept telling him, just say after me, say after me. He wants him to say the dua of when you're struck with a calamity. Allahumma ajirni fi musibati. Wakhlifni khayran minha. And the guy is just not, no, too angry. Then what happened? We prayed dhuhr. We had tea, some cookies, and khalas, he calmed down. While he's having his tea, he goes to the sheikh. Sheikh, what was that dua again? And the sheikh tells him, it's too late. Too late. You had your chance. Now after shai, tea, ustamakhet, you wanna? Now you wanna say the dua? Too late, Habibi. All right, last one, and we'll make it quick. And last one, you might find it a bit weird, but I think it's very relevant to how we are today in our lifestyle. It's basically Umar radiallahu anhu and his zuhd, that he didn't want of the materialism of this dunya. And the scholars say that zuhd for Umar stood out very much so. Because they said the dunya wasn't, by the dunya we mean the materialism and the wealth, wasn't that much during the time of Abu Bakr. During the time of Umar, there was so much wealth, radiallahu anhu, that, well, first of all, the Prophet ﷺ said in a hadith that the day of judgment will not come hatta yakthura fikum al-mal, until wealth increases amongst you. This just an interesting point about this hadith is that it's talking about something that will happen in the future, and it happened two times, and it's going to happen two other times. Ya'ni, this hadith will be applicable four times. They said the first time during the reign of Umar, there was so much wealth, because yakthur fikum, amongst you, the companions, one explanation. They said that some companions had so much wealth that when they died, you know how you take, hey, that's your gold, that's your share. They said they had to break their tariqah with an axe. Ya'ni, imagine you have so much gold that they have to chop it up with an axe. That's how much wealth they had. So there was a lot more wealth during the time of Umar. The second time is during the time of Umar ibn Abdul Aziz. The two other times in the future, one will be during the time of the Mahdi, because he will spread wealth everywhere. And the fourth time, this hadith will be applicable, is at the time of Isa ibn Maryam. There will be so much wealth and people have no value for wealth. Anyways, the point is that one of the companions said the following about Abu Bakr and Umar, comparing the worldly life in their times. He said, "Amma Abu Bakr, falam turidhu dunya walam yaridha." He says, as for Abu Bakr, like the world did not come at him, the materialism and wealth did not come at him, nor did he come towards it. He says, "Wa'amma Umar, fa'aradathu dunya walam yuridha." He said, as for Umar, the world came to him, but he didn't come to it. And it really stands out, the way he had wealth during the what is known as Am al-Ramada, the year of Ramada, which was the year the city was, Medina was struck with famine, for about 19 months. And it said that people's complexion changed because of the starvation and how they looked physically. And Umar radiallahu anhu, he had the storages and everything at his disposal, but he had vowed to eat nothing but oil and bread. Oil and bread. Until it's over. Until the famine is over, he said, I've vowed to eat nothing but oil and bread. Even the bread he used to eat wasn't like, they didn't like, you know, back then you would grind. Either you would have a windmill that would do it for you with the wind and grind the flour into real smooth powder, or you would do it yourself. Two heavy flat stones, grinding it. So sometimes you didn't do a full job, you just quickly grind it, keda, and you leave these kernels still in there. And any of you have tried to eat wheat or barley when it's dry, how hard is it? It's like a rock, isn't it? So there'll be some half pieces, have some quarter pieces. A man once came to visit Umar ibn Khattab, and he saw him eating this rough bread with just oil, dipping it in oil, and that's all he ate until his complexion changed. So he asked the man to eat with him, and the man said, "No, I'll eat later." And Umar could understand that he didn't like my food, the quality of my food. And then he responds to him in such a way that really shows you he understood good food. He says, "Atarani ajizan." He says, "Do you see that I'm not capable of bringing raisins and then soaking them in water until it becomes blood red, so that all the good stuff comes out of the raisins? It's going to be a juice now." He's describing the way to make that juice. Then he describes getting a deer, a gazelle specifically, and a young one, and then roasting it over a slow flame. Fahim, slow flame. And he describes the whole process, and the bread being grinding it finely, and then take from this, dip in that, and eat that. That's what he said, actually. He knows food, but he wasn't going to like fill his belly and everything while the ummah is starving. And he said, until this is over, I'm not going to eat anything but bread and oil. And he survived on bread and oil. And that's rough. So my closing is with this issue of eating and how the Prophet ﷺ said that the worst vessel you can fill is your stomach. مَا مَلَأَ ابْنُ آدَمْ وِعَاءً شَرَّ مِنْ بَطْنِهِ. The worst thing you can fill is your stomach. Then he said, حَسْبُ ابْنُ آدَمْ, sufficient for the son of Adam, a few bites to sustain him. Enough for the son of Adam, or a few bites to just keep you going. فَإِنْ كَانَ وَلَا بُدْ, if you have to, and there's no other way, then a third for the food, a third for the drink, a third for your air. This is the hadith, we always started here, right? We always start the hadith here, like that's, you know, the minimum, a third, a third, a third, right? But the hadith says that's the maximum. What you should do, just eat a few bites to sustain you. And what is interesting is that food that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala put on earth to give us nutrition and sustenance and energy and all that is making people sick. It wasn't intended to make people sick. So one of two things are probably wrong, or both are wrong. And I believe both are wrong. One, the ingredients, what we're putting in the food, there's something wrong with that. Two, the amount of food that we're eating, something wrong with that. 150 years ago, anyone living in America consumed 2 pounds of sugar a year. Do you know how much we consume this year? Not now? Per year? From 2 pounds a year to how much? Take a guess. 150 pounds of sugar a year. And that's another human being. And I'm a little over 150, like putting another kamal of sugar, and I just eat them in a year. And all this is processed by you're not processed by, but you know, your poor little pancreas. How big is your pancreas, Dr. Abdullah? Huh? It's not that big. Yeah? And your beta cells, and it's all this work. And so was your body designed to take this much sugar in? Or all these other things that we're doing? So And that's why the best thing is to decrease how much we eat. Okay? I know we break that rule at events and stuff, but if we could just maintain and control how much we eat. And so one quote Umar used to make was really powerful. He used to say, "Woe to the one whose stomach leads him to the hellfire." He would say that while he would eat this bread with the oil. Why? And it's such a nice idea and a thought. He's saying, you can live on anything. You can live on anything. He's living off of, for how many months? Bread and oil. So he used to say, woe to the one whose stomach takes him to the hellfire. Why let this be what will take you to the hellfire? Filling it with haram or eating something that's, you know, doubtful or has this issue with it. Why would you do that? You can survive on anything. So why would this be what will put you in trouble with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? And it's just about control. And one of the things we lack the most now in our world now is everything is instant gratification and there's no self-control. Even when you put the food, a wise man once told me, he says, when I'm at a table and they put the food and we're waiting for someone, first of all, that's an etiquette, barakallahu fikum, never forget. If we all order our food and one guy's food hasn't come yet, wait for him to get his food before we start eating. But he said, I will know who's impatient because they start nibbling, they can't wait. We're waiting for some guy to wash his hands and this guy, fry, olive, musharif, baba ghanouj. The discipline and the way Umar could just handle himself and just keep this in check and the etiquette anyways that we're supposed to eat little and control that, that's just, in the world we're in right now, perhaps it was worth mentioning. I apologize for going a little bit too long, but jazakumullah khairan for staying and for your attentive listening. Sallallahu barak ala Muhammad, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Is Abu Bakr next week?